Engaging the audience by being expressive with our music, that's our job as performers. We strive for our audience to have the best experience. Who taught you this? Did you learn it by watching others, or did you just figure it out along the way? Welcome back to Accelerando. My name is Paula Tuttle, and today we're looking at some of the data about members of the audience and a little projecting about what we listen for too. The truth is, there's no curriculum in music conservatories for teaching how to connect with the audience. Some teachers will talk about it, but the schools are dedicated to the technical, theoretical, and compositional aspects of music. For instrumentalists, we are left to learn the rest on our own. We call it experience. For singers, it's different, since they're not using their arms for playing their instruments and they're not required to sit or hold up an instrument. They learn to do things with their arms, legs, and mouth. Singers are taught to connect with the audience, and conductors do the same. Musicians, not so much. When we have a singer join our ensemble, we definitely want her to be expressive. Looking at the audience, using a lot of arm motions, facial expressions that keep the listeners involved. She does all of that. She might connect with individuals during the concert. So in, say, a string quartet concert, the players are focused on one another. They don't engage the audience by making eye contact, but some of the audience wants to look for clues about the interaction between the players. So let's say you're a string player, you might decide after a few minutes that this particular quartet has some telepathy going on and there's not much to witness. So you might focus on the performance and the individuals. The standard with orchestral musicians is a lot less movement than soloists, but many people want to see how they move. It's important to some listeners more than others. So a solo wind player might nod their head a bit or move forward when there's an important part, signaling the audience, look over here. The conductor should be engaging the audience by motioning to the instruments that have important parts. He's definitely doing a job for the musicians and the audience. He keeps the soldiers in line while giving the audience direction by showing the mood and character of the music. If you wanted data on this kind of thing, you could do a mini questionnaire to the audience members. 1. What instrument, if any, do you identify with? 2. Do you watch the players of this instrument more than, say, 25% of the time? And 3. Do you watch the conductor more than 25% of the time? And 4. How important is it to you to be close to the players? Last month, I went to a concert in one of the most beautiful churches in Pittsburgh, St. Anthony's on Troy Hill. I was just barely in time for the concert, and the church was pretty full, so I sat in the very back. I had never been in this church before, but I knew it housed the largest collection of religious relics in North America. But I wasn't prepared for the aesthetic beauty of the nave. There was a large skylight in the apex, and the late afternoon light gave the room a glow that was exquisite. As soon as I walked in, I knew I wanted to look around. There was gold leaf on about 25% of the surfaces, and the station statues that were larger than life made the room a museum. Soon the concert began, and the leader, Warren Davidson, spoke from the back in the organ loft. Everyone turned to look behind them. The concert was performed out of sight from the listeners. To me, it was above my head. The seat I had chosen was closer to the action, but I couldn't see anything, and I hadn't expected to see the performers in any case. Everything sounded fabulous. The organ was recently refurbished by Peter Lully and was perfect in the space, accompanying cellist Jacob Nathanson and soprano Katie Williams. The acoustics were warm and reverberant. After the concert, many audience members said they were disappointed they couldn't watch the players and see their expressions. I realized I was in the minority where I didn't mind not being able to watch the players, at least in this particular instance. And I know I'm not alone in this. A lot of professional musicians agree the best seats are at the top of Heinz Hall and the top balcony of Carnegie Music Hall. And many times I've sat in the first few rows of those stages on the first half and then moved to the balcony on the second half, and I'm always glad I did. At St. Anthony's, the people that sat up front had a great view of the gorgeous altar and the cases of relics all around. But they were mostly there to watch the performers, which none of us were able to do. I understand their disappointment, too. They really came to watch the players, and some were family. I don't think my experience would have been any better if I sat up close. Sometimes watching can be a distraction. One of the greatest things about music is that you can enjoy it without seeing the players. Researchers have talked about whether people have a better experience when they can see the performers, and I say it's a mixed bag. Two scientists, Marcella Wanderley and Bradley Vines, they found that non-musician listeners are extremely sensitive to physical gestures that musicians make. They look to the arms, shoulders, and torso movements to divine the expressive intentions of the musician. Part of the study was to show a video of performances without any sound, and this is how they found the differences between musicians and non-musicians. The non-musicians actually sensed a lot of expression watching the video with the sound turned off. Professional musicians did not benefit at all from watching the video with the sound turned off. They might have been able to imagine the music, but the video did nothing to help them sense expression. Really? Professional musicians and non-performers watch performances in different ways. It's a fact. Non-performers are trying to derive emotions from the movements of the players, while professionals are looking for interpretation and depth of training from the music they hear. This is not to say that non-professional listeners are having lesser enjoyment or are remembering less of the performance, but it might be worth our while to think about what the ticket buyers want to see and hear. And this leads to some even more interesting finds, because both kinds of listening and watching by the different groups are about the neurological paths in the brain. We see that non-musicians' neural paths react to the motions the way musicians' brains react to the sounds, the music itself. Are you not even a little surprised by this? Now, we're not saying that we are different species, not at all. In truth, the professional musicians are deeply connected to the motions and muscle movements they make, and they need to feel a certain way every time they play a piece, or at least it starts that way and it may change or evolve over time. But if a musician performs the same work 100 times, he sets into motion a series of commands, including emotions, that he repeats time and time again. So what we're saying is that if you play the blues, you need to feel the blues. And if you want to communicate the most warm and passionate music, then you need to feel warm and passionate. And you'll need to create both the feelings and the motions each time you play the piece. Stevie Wonder, talking about when he performs, he says he tries to get into the frame of mind or the frame of heart he was in when he wrote a particular piece. And he tries to capture the same feelings and sentiment, and it helps him deliver the performance. So to neuroscientists, this makes scientific sense. They think in terms of memories and getting neurons to fire at rates close or to the same as original levels. I heard about this from a non-music teacher, Donna Perkins. She's well known in the theater circles here, and she taught us how to recreate those frames of mind before performances. It's a thing. When actors do the same show every night, they can't rely on inspiration as such. They have to make their brain fire the neurons to make the recreation. It's their job. They have to get into character. And lots of musicians will tell you they do the same. They found their own way, but each of us has a process, a familiarity, that makes us able to deliver performances consistently. And though we might make the same motions every night, we are connected to what comes out. And I think it's how we listen to concerts, too. So in essence, we're not that different from our audience members. When we go outside our field, say we go to a play, and we look for the motions, too, it's a big part of understanding the work. As orchestral musicians, we don't move nearly as much as actors or soloists. Maybe conservatories should include these ideas in their curriculum. Both Daniel Curtis and Monique Mead have developed electives at CMU for stagecraft. They talk about stage presence, when to bow, how to engage the audience, some public speaking, and more. An experimental workshop about movement and expression would be a great addition to performance degrees. It's only been about 50 years since the performance aspect of conservatories moved into doctoral degrees. Before that, it was only composition and theory and other academic-sided subjects that were allocated to the highest diplomas. I see the future of curriculums moving in the direction of focus on moving and engaging and helping the audience understand the music. Next time you go to the symphony, think about what it's like to be a non-performer. What are they looking at? What are they seeing? How can we help them? Thanks for listening. Have a great week.